You are listening to Oscar Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Oscar series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena. My pronouns are she, her. And I am joined today by two amazing guests who are doing a no-holds-barred discussion about conversion therapy and their experiences. Today I'm joined by Elena Joy. Thank you for joining me, Elena.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a speaker and a founder of a nonprofit and a mom of four beautiful kids and, yeah, and a lesbian. And my pronouns are she, her, and I am a conversion therapy survivor, so hence I am enjoying being on your program.
And I'm joined by Ray D. Magden. Ray, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, I'm Ray D. Magden. My pronouns are she, her. I'm an author of 10 books with the label Desert Palm Press. My latest release is Lucky Seven, which is a cyberpunk novel about a whole crew of queer characters taking down evil corporations with virtual heists. And it won a Golden Crown Literary Award and a Rainbow Award. So I'm really happy to be here today.
Fantastic.
It's tough to talk about this stuff, but I also think it's really important.
So just before we get into it, let's just do a quick intro on both of you. You're both conversion therapy survivors, and so you're here today to talk about your experiences and give a real life perspective on this topic. Elena, let's start with you.
So I am in my 40s. I have four kids that I share custody with my ex-husband. And I am now a public speaker and activist. I very publicly speak about my experiences and testify about the damage it can do to communities. I have recently started a nonprofit so that it is dedicated to building self-awareness and safety in LGBTQ families and their allies. It was something I had on the back burner for a long time, but then when quarantine hit and my public speaking events were all canceled, it became really clear that we have this population that are kind of trapped right now in homes that are not affirming for them, whether they are adults or young adults or children. I've just thought a lot about if I was quarantined with my ex-husband in my old community right now, and that would not be a safe situation for anyone. So it was definitely feeling like now is the time to really reach out to these families and support them and help them with tools and resources during this time.
And this is where the Pride and Joy Foundation comes in.
That's right. Correct. Yes. So I had been married 17 years before I fully realized my sexuality. And I was involved in a very high demand religion. And if I left my husband, it literally meant I would not be returning to heaven. And so I, as an adult, as a 37-year-old, willingly tried this therapy to try to be fixed and try to keep my place in heaven.
And we'll get more into that. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I really enjoy being here, and I'm really appreciative that you have created this platform. And in doing so, you are passing the mic to help spread the message. I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you guys taking the time. I know that traumatic events are not easy to talk about. So if you need time or if you want to not cover something, please tell me as we're going through them.
Of course.
All right, Ray, let's move on to you.
Yes, I have written over 10 novels featuring queer characters. Many of them are women identified who are sexually attracted and romantically attracted to other women. That's primarily what I write. And that has definitely come because one of my sources of strength when I was coming out or was outed was stories about women who are queer like me and got happy endings, because I was told over and over again that that wasn't possible and that being attracted to women, being in a relationship with a woman was a recipe for depression, for, of course, not getting into heaven, for a whole host of awful things. And the stories I read online by other queer women kind of paved the way for me to accept myself and become a healthy adult, mostly. a healthy adult. And so I kind of wanted to do this because at first I thought I was underqualified to do this, because when people think of conversion therapy, they often think of physical abuse, and I was not physically abused with my conversion therapy. And so I'm like, well, why am I even qualified to speak on this when someone like Elena is going to be on this podcast who, you know, has testified to her experience in front of government agencies? And it's like, why me? What do I have to contribute? And I thought, well, it would have been really, really affirming and healing for me to have heard from someone that, A, even if you're not physically abused, what you went through is still abuse and it can still be classified as conversion therapy. And two, that not everyone who puts their child in that situation is necessarily a horrible, evil person who wants to harm their child. Lots of them are very well-meaning family members and members of their communities, often religious communities. And if I had heard someone name this thing that I was going through earlier, it would have been a lot less difficult for me to untangle in therapy later, and I would have felt a lot more supported and seen. So that's why I decided to do this.
One of my goals with the Oscar series is to not get people who are necessarily the typical poster child for a certain, you know, whatever it is we're discussing. I wanted people across the board on this one. I wanted people who had gone through a range of experiences so that we're aware that this is an insidious thing.
Yeah, because I mean, when I think of conversion therapy, I used to think of the Criminal Minds episode where they go into the camp and all the boys are plugged into like the electroshock machines in front of the TV showing heterosexual porn. And like, that never happened to me. That was not my experience. But my experience is still common. I would say more common. And so I wanted to testify to the damage that it can cause.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of danger in saying that an evil exists only in one population, in one segment, you know, because then we ignore it and then we minimize it. We minimize both the evil and the population by doing that. And so once you're able to break it out and say, no, this affects everyone, everyone, even if you think that you don't know any people that this affects, it actually affects your home, because conversion therapy creates damaged people, whether those are children or adults. And then they grow up and they become damaged members of society. Therefore, this affects society and is a society problem, not just a gay problem.
That's actually a really great point. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, electroshock therapy is what comes to mind. But let's talk about what was your experience? What actually happened? Elena, since you're already on the path, let's start with you.
Sure. So I always teach that conversion therapy is very simple because of the end goal that it has in mind. It wants to suppress same-sex attraction and result in heteronormative attraction. So any quote-unquote therapy who has that goal in mind is conversion therapy. Therefore, you have a spectrum, and on one end of the spectrum, you do have the rarely physically abusive forms, which electroshock therapy, like you said, is what we all think of. A really popular one right now, for especially at the kids' camps, are showing the homoerotic images and then forcing them to drink a charcoal drink, which makes them vomit. And so we think we've moved past electroshock therapy, but we have not. Like, that is still very prevalent as a physically damaging way of, again, quote unquote, therapy. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have people in a power dynamic, so we'll call them a therapist, who is there in the room with you saying, I know how to heal you. You have a problem. You are broken in some way. And if you pay me the right amount of money, or if you donate to my organization or church, I will fix you and your path will be right again. And that is just as damaging, definitely in different ways, but just as damaging and just as valid of a traumatic experience across conversion therapy. And that was definitely my interaction with it. So My sexuality came to light between my religious leader and my husband. And it was decided, okay, Elena needs help. She is broken. And a friend says, oh, I know a guy who helps with this. Go see him. So I was asked by a reporter yesterday, like, did your church provide the counseling? No, they did not. They got out of that business in the last 20 years. But what they do now is they know who is available in the community who does this work. And if you need financial help paying for it, because it's not cheap, then the church will help provide funds for that. So that's kind of a gray, interesting area to me. I did not have the church provide funds. My husband was doing very well financially, and we both really wanted to save our marriage. And so we paid for it ourselves. And the concept was, his concept, the therapist's concept, was simply, yeah, something happened in your past, and it caused same-sex attraction, and we're going to find it, and we're going to heal it, and then that attraction's going to go away. And you're not going to struggle. You're not going to be in this pit anymore. You're not going to hate yourself anymore. I'm going to help you achieve all of that. You need to come 4 days a week, 2 hours a day, at $270 a day. And I will fix this problem within you. And so for me, it was very much a constant. Like, I'd get up, I'd get my kids off to school. I might do some chores around the house, and then off I go to therapy for 2 hours. And you know, any therapy session is just exhausting, right? You're crying and you're just dealing with some heavy crap. And then I come home and my kids get home from school and we're going to do homework and laundry and dinner and dishes and put you to bed. And then I had my homework assignments from my therapist, a lot of journaling, a lot of processing, a lot of reading, and then crash and then get up and do it again. And so you get in this mindset of, I am so broken. I need so much help because I am so broken. And when you are physically and mentally, emotionally exhausted, it's very hard to see clarity, right? It's very hard to see even logic at that time. So that was my experience. I got about 2 months in and he found all kinds of memories from childhood, crazy memories that we all have, right? All of our parents are nuts because I'm nuts. Like, we all have craziness. And then at the end of 2 months, he was like, oh, there must be something you're not telling me. And with that went for like 3 days. And the pressure was intense because my husband is like, you got to figure this out. And we are paying a lot of money for this. And our marriage is on the line. Like, figure it out. And so finally, on the third or fourth day that week, I went in and I admitted to this man something that had happened to me at 15 that was horrible, that I had never talked about, not to my parents, not to the police, not to my husband of 17 years. No one knew about this experience. I hadn't even thought about it since the night that it had happened. I had just shut it down. Classic trauma, right? And he was like, this is it. This is why you're broken. Okay, we're going to heal this. And then you're not going to be attracted to this woman anymore. So that was horrific because not only was I a victim at 15, but then at age 37, I was a victim again. Like, oh, I was hurt. And now it has screwed with me. Like, now I'm a victim again. Now I'm broken. Now I am in this emotional roller coaster and screwed because of this thing that happened to me when I was 15. So that took, I was in for another 3 months, 3.5 months, dealing with that every day for 2 hours. And then finally, luckily, wonderfully, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings were happening, and which of course was triggering for like 75% of the female population, right? Like, that was ridiculous. And the Me Too movement was going gangbusters. And so we were all realizing that women like Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, had gone through these assaults and they were survivors. And the statistics started coming out that possibly 75% of American women have been assaulted at some time in their life. And that's when it finally clicked in my head. 75% of American women are not gay at all. Like, not even close. Like, maybe 5% of American women are attracted to other women. Those numbers don't correlate. And it was this huge eye-opening experience realizing, why did I not figure this out 6 months ago? And second of all, oh yeah, I have these friends, these very good friends who had gone through horrible assaults and trauma as children, but who were very much attracted to men, who had very healthy sexual relationships with men. If anyone should hate being with a man, it should be them, and they don't. So then realizing, like, it doesn't work backwards the other way either. Like, this doesn't prove out in any way, shape, or form. I am not broken. Like, yes, I was a victim at 15, but I'm not broken. This attraction to this woman is not something that needs to be healed. And so that was how I was able to end it, was coming to that realization. But yes, that was my experience. And unfortunately, during it, I became one of the statistics that had suicidal ideations. And luckily, I was able to get really good help. And I think that's why I was finally able to see, to put those concepts together, that this was not a valid, logical stance to have, that because you're damaged as a kid, that means you're attracted to the same sex as an adult. Because I was finally able to sleep. I was finally able, like, my anxiety finally calmed down. My depression finally calmed down, right? Like, because I had real help in my life, unfortunately, because it had gotten so distressing. But luckily, the real help was there. And that was how I was able to kind of climb out of that emotional pit that I was in. So yeah, that was my experience in a nutshell.
It's interesting, while you were talking, you use the word therapy in air quotes. People can't see, so I'm just explaining. But actually, that makes a really good point, because it's not a therapy. It's not fixing anything. It's doing damage. So just calling it conversion therapy is actually really bad. So what should we call it?
Well, there's a name that's been penned. It's an acronym. And it works out to be like SOGICE or SOGI. And it basically is about identifying with gender and sexuality and the attempt of changing that. I forget what the actual words are. But because no one, like, that phrase is not used, and so the average person on the street does not know what that is, it's very hard to use in conversation. I agree. I hate that the word therapy is combined with it, because we're really trying to destigmatize that real therapy, right? We're trying to destigmatize the mental health issues. Like, and so we want therapy to be a good word that everyone can access and that is helpful and no connotation of brokenness, right? Unfortunately, conversion therapy or reparative therapy, it's the colloquialism that we have to use for people to understand what it is. But it gives it a validity that it does not have.
Absolutely. Thank you for being an awesome listener and supporting Tilt, the channel that brings you all the podcasts you want to hear. You're listening to Tilt. Find more podcasts on thelesbiantalkshow.com. Ray, would you like to talk about your experiences?
Yeah. So my experience was quite different. I knew that I was attracted to women from very early childhood. I knew when I was about 5, I was watching Disney's Aladdin, and I thought, wow, Jasmine's really pretty. So she was kind of my queer awakening. And it was odd because I was in a very sheltered home, to a certain extent, and queerness was not talked about or mentioned, even in passing, as a thing that existed, let alone an option. So when I hit puberty, and it hit me back with a vengeance, I started having very sexual feelings for women that I did not understand and had no frame of reference for. So the only frame of reference I had was, I thought there might be some kind of demon inside me because I was, I was from a very religious family. I'm still in contact with my family. And they have made steps toward accepting me, which I'm very grateful for. I know not everyone is able to maintain their family and community ties after they come out. But I was fortunate to be able to do that. Would not recommend it for everyone, just for me personally. But I felt terrified because even though this was never really discussed openly, I knew that it was not normal and it was wrong. I'm going to use air quotes now. And so I thought that the best solution would be to try and kill myself. And fortunately, before I seriously injured myself, I got scared at the sight of blood and I went down to my mom and I told her what happened. And luckily for me, her response was to put me in real therapy with a real doctor. And I didn't tell her about the queer part, so she didn't know. She just thought that, oh, my daughter has depression. So she put me in real therapy with a real therapist, a secular therapist, and that is probably what saved my life because I had that counteracting influence. And it's why I'm still in contact with my mom, because she cared and she did the right thing for me at a very critical juncture. And my dad, too. I mean, I say my mom because she was the one I went to for help, but she, my dad obviously was supportive in the same sense. But then I committed the great sin of falling in love with my best friend at the time. I'm actually married to that person now. My husband, Tori, he's a trans man. At the time, we both thought that he was female because he didn't know he was trans yet. But at the time, I was in, I'm going to use air quotes again, a lesbian relationship. At least that's what we assumed it was. And I was talking on the phone one night to one of my friends about this relationship, and I was overheard. So I was outed. I was about 16. Maybe I'd just turned 16. So I wasn't maliciously outed, but I was outed. I was planning to not tell until after I finished college, because then I had an escape plan. Because even though my parents had been nothing but supportive, I had that fear in the back of my mind that if they knew this about me, that I would be disowned, I would be kicked out on the street. I carried a card in my purse with the number of a local LGBTQ shelter on it from my city. I told them this years later, and they were horrified that I would think that. But, I mean, that's what you see so often, and I was prepared for the worst. So when I was overheard, my mom again did something right. She told me, the first thing she told me was not that I was sinful and going to hell. The first thing she told me was, please don't kill yourself. So I was incredibly lucky in that sense. And honestly, though, it made it harder for me to work on this later, because it's easy when you have a villain in your play to cast as the villain. It's easy in some ways, not every way. In some ways, it's easy when your parents are shitty and abusive because then you can just cut them out of your life and say everything they taught you is wrong. And you don't question it because you know that it's wrong. There's so much evidence that it's wrong. But then she did something, unfortunately, that was very damaging to me, and that is she scheduled sessions with our priest. We come from an Orthodox background, Eastern Orthodoxy. If you've ever seen the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, it's a very funny, cute movie, but that is the religion I come from, and it is, unfortunately, at times very homophobic. And, you know, when you hear about hate crimes in Russia, that's a branch of that religion. So she scheduled sessions with our priest, a very quiet and unassuming man named Father Jim, and I was forced to sit in a room with Father Jim while he tried to basically diminish, poke holes in my burgeoning queer identity that was still very fragile, because I was still very fragile as a teenager. And just, I was stuck in this room with this authority figure for long periods of time with him telling me that I was broken. Lots of weird contradictory stuff. I mean, there was, if you act on homosexual attractions, which is what they call it, then you're going to not get into heaven, that it is disrespecting your body, that it is sinful, that it can cause your mental illnesses. And that was a really tricky one because it gave me the idea that I didn't deserve to be happy because something was wrong with me. And that idea has stuck with me and persisted into adulthood, that I don't deserve to be happy because something is wrong with me. And later, many years later, I went to a monastery in an effort to try to reconcile my identity with my faith one last time. So I went to a monastery, I had to wear a veil, I had to get rid of all my technology, I had to basically be in church all day, every day for like 8 days. I paid to go there, and I had a one-hour meeting with the abbess at this monastery, and she only spoke Greek, so I had to have a translator, and she basically informed me that all of my mental health issues were because I was queer. And I eventually decided that this loving relationship I had with my, at the time we were engaged, so fiance, but now we're married, this loving, supportive relationship that I had been in since I was 14 was the cause of all the despair in my life. And that didn't track. So then I just nodded and I thanked her and I left money and I went home and I never went back to church. Until recently, where I attended an Easter service virtually with some Episcopalian friends that are part of an open and affirming church. So, and that's been really hard. I mean, people talk about the dangers that religion does, but they don't often talk about what depriving someone spiritual of their religion does. I don't have something that a lot of people have, which is a relationship with God, a trust in a higher power that things are going to be okay. And especially in times now, like when there's this whole global pandemic and there's so many awful things happening in the world, sometimes that stuff can sustain you. It is your spiritual armor against the world. And being deprived of that left me incredibly vulnerable in addition to my psychological vulnerabilities. So, yeah. But like I said, there wasn't any physical abuse, but I guess the overall message I want to give in this first section is that even a little bit can really fuck you up. Sorry to swear, but like even a couple sessions with an authority figure telling you that you're broken and you're going to hell and just trying to invalidate you and who you are at every turn can mess you up for decades to come. And we don't want people in our society with that kind of damage if we can prevent it, because like you said, Elena, messed up children become messed up adults and they make life harder for all of us and they can even go on to damage other people. Unfortunately, I've met a lot of other queer people in my community who have lots of unhealthy ideas about themselves, about queerness, about relationships, about religion, about everything. And a lot of it can be traced back to this kind of abuse, this kind of spiritual and psychological abuse. So if we want our community to be healthy and if we want the world to be healthy, even outside of our queer community, we have to take steps to prevent this.
Both of you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you both seem to have come from environments where your family seemed to have wanted to do what was good for you, what was best for you.
Yes, definitely. I mean, my parents were trying the best they knew how. I don't think they believed that I could have a happy life as a queer woman.
I agree. And oftentimes, man, Ray, the story of your mom just really touched my heart. And I think oftentimes, without the skills of self-awareness, parents often, especially moms, we often immediately go to that, oh, I screwed up somehow. This is my fault. Like somehow I've created a child who's now going to have a really hard life. And I love my child. I don't want a really hard life for her. And so because we've taken it in as moms and made it really personal, like I must have screwed up somehow. Well, now logic kind of flies out the window, right? And we just think, how can I help my child? How can I make amends, right? How can I help my child not have such a hard life? And when you have an authority figure like a priest or a bishop or whomever who says, I have a solution, like, why wouldn't a loving, caring mom go that path, right? And I honestly feel like it's just a lack of, okay, if we knew as moms how to stop and say, okay, this is really triggering for me. I'm feeling really self-conscious of myself and my role as a mom. Why is this triggering so much? Why do I have such anxiety? And being able to take that step back and realizing, okay, well, there are actually a lot of lesbians out there that are really functional and are really happy. And I can use some logic and not just emotion to respond to this. And that's one of my biggest goals, is to be able to teach parents, when your child comes out to you, this is what could hurt them in your response. And this is what could really build them up in your response, right? I feel like that should be like parenting 101. Can we give them all a class before they take the baby home? like everyone needs this information, because at some point someone is going to come out to you. A child, if you're a good person and they trust you, or if you're their parent, someone is going to come out to you. And you're in this position of incredible trust, right? Whether they've been outed or not, you're now in a position where you're either going to damage that relationship or it's going to become better. And every mom wants that relationship to become better, for that connection to be stronger, right? It's just that every mom doesn't have the tools to know what makes it better.
I was just also wondering if the prevalence of queer representation in media, it's seen a major spike in the last 10 years or so, right? So for the first time, we're actually seeing positive representation. Before that, we didn't see it. So it was this kind of hidden, secretive, must be wrong kind of space. So what was interesting for me is you were both talking about your parents looking to authority figures for the solutions. And those authority figures both had the sense that being queer is completely wrong and it's going to keep you out of heaven.
Yeah, for sure. That was definitely, I think, something my parents were worried about.
Is that changing now? Now that there is the representation, now that there is more positive spaces being seen, more positive rep being seen on TV, in movies, or is there a pushback because of it?
I'm sure in some cultures you definitely find a pushback, for sure. But I think if you're talking about an overall trend, I do feel like it's changing. For example, a few weeks ago, I'm part of a group that is like, we've all evolved past the church that we were in, right? So we don't call ourselves ex-Mormons, we call ourselves post-Mormons, right? We've kind of evolved past that. And so I'm part of that group, and there's this other woman that's in there with me, and we used to live in the same neighborhood. Like, we very much had the same life, right? And then our lives exploded and we moved on. And she, 3 years ago, was a totally different person, as I was, as many of us are. And I get a call from her, and she's like, okay, my fiance's out of town and my soon-to-be stepson is here with me, and he just came out to me last night and his dad doesn't know, and I don't know if I responded well. And she was like, this is what I said, and then he said this and I said this, right? And she handled it wonderfully. She really did. But 3 years ago, she wouldn't have, right? 3 years ago, it would have been a really damaging conversation. So just in that one example, I feel like I see in my community and in my peers a huge shift in the trend. Like, because we can look at women like Ellen and, right? I mean, she's like the trophy child there, right? And even now during quarantine, we're seeing that, oh, she's not perfect. She actually has quite a few flaws, as we all do. So now I think we're moving beyond like queer heroes, and we're getting to, oh yeah, queer people are really just people. And even the queer celebrities are really just people, and things are becoming way more normalized. I think we're on a very good trend. Now, to your point, is there a lot of pushback? Well, all we have to do is look at the crazy rallies that are happening in every city, and we can see a huge demographic that doesn't want anything to change. And in fact, they want it to go back to the way it was 50 years ago. So that's a little scary, and I think that we have to be aware of that. Certainly to ignore it is not helping the situation whatsoever, but we don't have to be consumed by it, because I think the overall trend is that it's just being normalized. It's just something to respond well about and to move on. It's not the end of someone's life. It's just a part of them that is amazing and wonderful, and we move on.
I think my parents, again, an interesting case because they're very liberal people in many senses. They think Trump is absolutely horrible. So in some sense, and I mean, she did a lot of things right as a parent. She offered to get me birth control and she taught me about sex correctly. She said sex is a very spiritual and emotional thing, and ideally it should be between a husband and wife, but we're human and we're all fallible, and so if you do have sex, here is birth control. She got me the HPV vaccine. So, I mean, in some sense, they're very liberal. They have gay colleagues. My dad is a doctor. He has gay patients. Not a therapist. He's a surgeon. Cancer. Yeah, in many ways, they're very liberal, but when their child was queer, they couldn't handle it. And I think even when they see representation in the media, back to your question, they consider it a worldly thing. Like, there's this way they act around people who are not of the faith, and it's respectful, but a little bit distant. And then when they're interacting with people that are of the faith, they consider them family, they are in this different world with them. And the fact that I was breaking the rules of this small introverted world was really hard for them to handle. And Orthodoxy in particular it's kind of weird. It's not a branch of Christianity that goes out and tries to find converts. It's more about guarding the mystical treasures of the faith and being stewards of those treasures and protecting them and unchanged for thousands of years. So Orthodoxy doesn't like to change. It's a dinosaur. It's Catholicism on steroids. It doesn't want to change in any meaningful way. And so it's all about tradition. And if people, you can live in the secular world, but if you abandon the spiritual world, then you won't get into heaven and you will be parted from God forever. And that's the worst thing that I think that they can think of, is to be separate from God for your eternity. And they were terrified of that happening to me, their daughter that they loved. And I think it drove them to do some extreme things that they would not have otherwise done. And there's still some pushback. Like, sometimes when I try to talk about what happened to me, they are a bit in denial. So on the one side, they're very accepting in some ways. You know, they are in contact with me. They give me support in basically every other area of my life that is not touching my queerness in some way, like it has cooties. They use the correct name and pronouns for my partner, which is a big thing. They understand that that's a respect thing. Like, you call someone by the name they want to be called by, and that holds true whether you're cis or trans or non-binary or anything. So they got that, which I'm grateful for, because I was prepared to end the relationship if they were not gonna do it. But they did it. I didn't even have to make a big stink about it. So they have rules of engagement for the secular world, but then there's this whole other set of rules for the spiritual community, and when I violated those rules, I don't want to say punished. I was punished, but they didn't view it that way. They viewed it as trying to help me. So, but yeah, any media with queer people is that's the secular world. That has nothing to do with spirituality in their world. It's a really weird dichotomy that there's mom going to anti-Trump rallies. Although it makes sense in a way, because in some ways, she's the spicy kind of Christian that is, like, fiercely advocating for the poor and people who are not part of this spiritual treasure community. And then on the other hand, like, her queer daughter, she can't really handle it. It is hard because I can't talk about my career with her a lot. I have to be as vague as possible because my books involve queer people. So, like, she's never read my book. She's not going to be celebrating my launches with me anytime soon. I sent her a picture of the award I won last year from the Golden Crown Literary Society for Lucky Seven. And she did text me back congratulations with a smiley face, but like that was the end of our conversation about that. So
that is like the biggest thing that I'm trying to communicate to parents is if you don't reconcile your own issues on the inside, you are going to miss out on these amazing experiences with your kids. And and the issue is within her, right? Like we could blame it on a faith community, but she's obviously very connected with her spirituality because she feels spiritually motivated to take care of people and to fight against evil and right. And that's completely outside of the framework of the community. So now when it's in her own, with her own daughter, it's like internal issues that she has to deal with. And man, I wish she could, I just feel so sad that like in 20 years, she's going to look back and realize I could have had all these memories with my daughter. I could have celebrated her awards. I could have been reading first drafts of her book. And like, you know what I mean? Like there's so many missed opportunities and I feel so bad. Oh.
It's tough. And it's also, it's hard for me to speak to my experiences of abuse and the pain I feel and the damage I sustained because she is such a loving parent who tried so hard.
Absolutely.
Like I tell other queer people about my mom and they're like, oh my God, your mom is like a hero. And at the same time, it's like, yeah, she kind of is. She kind of is my hero, but she also really messed me up.
Right, and to your point from earlier,
like, how am I supposed to deal with that? And that's why I've been in therapy for the past like decade.
Because to your point, like it almost makes it worse. Like when you have a really good person that you respect and you love, and they can't interact with you in a respectful way, or they really struggle to interact with you in a respectful way, it only confirms and feeds that concept of wow, I really am broken.
Yeah, yes, because if this wonderful good person who only wants my best interest is telling me this, who has always supported me, that I'm doing something wrong, I'm going to respect their opinion. And I'm going to think that, yeah, it's just really difficult not to share these parts of my life with them. My mom and I talk on the phone, you know, once every 2 weeks or so, at least. And she asks, what's new in your life? And I just freeze. What am I going to say? Oh, I made a new friend because they're in the same fandom that I am. Or, oh, I went to a convention and met a whole bunch of really cool queer celebrities. Not right now, obviously, but in the past, I went to a lot of conventions before we were confined to our homes. And I can't tell her about so many parts of my life. She didn't go to my wedding. She couldn't handle it. She wrote me a letter. She said that she didn't want to make me sad on the day because she was going to be sad. I get it, but at the same time, like, that's a hurt that's never going to go away, that my mom wasn't there for my wedding. My dad didn't go to the wedding either. He went to the reception. So he kind of split the difference between me and mom. I don't know if there's going to be any parents listening to this who are considering conversion therapy for their kids, but I hope there are. And, I mean, you're going to miss so much of your kid's life if they survive. Yeah, I mean, if my mom had not been educated enough to understand that mental illness is real and that her daughter urgently needed help before I came out, and if she hadn't put me in therapy with a real therapist, I would not be here. Absolutely.
I agree. That's like the biggest driving force of my work is I have this dream in my head that, you know, some kid comes out to their parents. And the next day, dad goes to work and he's telling his best friend at work, dude, my son just came out to me. I love my son, but it's hard to be a gay man in America right now. Like, I don't want my son to have a hard life. And my goal is that when he Googles or his best friend at work Googles, you know, how can I fix my son? And conversion therapy comes up, that it's a podcast like this. That they're like, oh, I'll listen to that on the way home. And they'll realize very quickly that, yeah, you probably need therapy to connect with your son and to have a really good relationship with your son. But don't do conversion therapy because you will screw him up and you will live with that for the rest of your life. Like that is my goal with every podcast interview that I do, with every talk that I do, that it becomes common knowledge that this practice is not safe. And then the demand for it goes away, and we don't have to have all the laws protecting people.
Yeah, I'm sure as a parent, in our emails, you were talking about like how you understand as a parent wanting to do what's best for your child and not wanting the government to restrict what kind of treatment you get your child. But with this, it's absolutely a safety concern. Like, you can't, if you want your kid to survive, don't put them through this. It doesn't matter if you're a well-meaning, loving, attentive parent, because this stuff will still mess you up. You can come from the most supportive parents in the world and this stuff will still mess you up.
Because at the fundamental core of it, people are telling you there's something wrong with you and you need to be fixed. And these are people you love and you trust.
Exactly. They're representative of the ultimate authority figure, which is God, right? They are representatives.
Absolutely. Right?
They are telling you this is what God wants you to hear. And so, of course, you're taking that in as much as possible. And you're trying, we're all trying to figure out how to be good humans. And so if we're being told by an authority figure, you're not a good human if you go down this path. Like, wow, that's a message to send to a kid or an adult.
Absolutely. And just quickly, something that I noticed, Ray, your parents, they seem like quite educated folks as well.
Oh, yeah. My dad is a doctor and also has an MBA in business. My mother was a speech pathologist, so she also has her doctorate.
Okay.
Highly educated people. Very intelligent people.
And Elena, if you don't mind me asking, the people in your life who were these average kind of working folks, or are we talking like very educated people here?
So my husband has his master's degree. He's now a partner with his firm, was within a year of getting partnership when I was doing conversion therapy. My bishop at the time owned his own business, no idea on his education status. And the quote unquote therapist was definitely an older gentleman. And what he communicated was that he had been a very active counselor and therapist for the state, in group homes and working with foster kids. And that's how he had spent like his career. And now he was semi-retired. And so no, he wasn't licensed anymore because he didn't want to keep up with the paperwork. So now he's just calling himself a coach, but this is his pedigree. This is where he came from. And this is what his experience is in.
So I think, let's bust the myth that this only happens to people who hate their kids, and let's bust the myth that this only happens in spaces where people are uneducated, because that's obviously BS.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have to recognize that this is everywhere, and it's because of the very basic concepts of homosexuality and its spectrum is wrong. Like, that's the very basis of it.
Yeah. Also, that's kind of why I took issue with the Taylor Swift video about homophobia, you know, her music video, because, you know, I think T-Swift gets a lot of shit just for being a famous woman. But at the same time, this video was pretty problematic because it showed all the homophobes as like dumb hicks with missing teeth and like torn flannel worn in strange ways and cars on their lawn that are broken down. And like, that's just not where homophobia lives, at least not exclusively. Yeah, I mean, rural communities can be very introverted, and if someone is different, they can be ostracized. I'm not denying that. But, I mean, sometimes very wealthy, very educated, very even stylish and fashionable people. I mean, look at Ivanka Trump. I mean, she's obviously part of a community that is very deeply homophobic, but she definitely doesn't match the whole hick idea. So you can't make that connection, that bridge, that leap of thinking. And then also you're putting the rural queers at risk if you're just lumping all of the more rural people in with homophobia and bigotry. So.
Right, because then the logic becomes, oh, well, just leave. Go to New York, go to Chicago, go to LA. Like, if you're being discriminated against, then that's your problem because you're staying in these icky places. Like,
well, I mean, I'd probably still give that advice to a queer living in a rural area, because where are you going? How are you going to get a date? But they shouldn't have to leave. You're right.
but it's happening everywhere. And it's not one of these things that happens necessarily behind closed doors in homes where it's already problematic.
I agree. One of the biggest realizations, I mean, I only came out when I was 37, right? So I still consider myself like a baby gay, where I'm really like experiencing a lot of things for the first time.
Wait, how long have you been out? I'm just curious.
So I'm 41 now, and I went public with my sexuality when I was 38. So it's been like 3 years. I fell in love with my girlfriend like 4 years ago. Right.
I've been out publicly at school for 14 to 29, 15 years. I've been out 5 times longer than you,
yes,
despite
you have.
Being 29.
Yes. So I had been out like maybe a year, and I had left my entire community, right?
I'm proud of you, Elena. Can I just say I'm very proud of you. It must have been so hard to come from that community and to get where you are to be such a happy and fulfilled lesbian. So good for you.
Thank you. I've had amazing support. It's been incredible. But I was out for about a year, and I was trying to maintain these friendships in this community, right? And to their credit, they were trying to maintain them with me as well. Like, we were trying to negotiate, how do you maintain a friendship that you've had for years when the fundamental framework doesn't work? And so I was at lunch with a couple of these friends from the old neighborhood, and we were just chatting, and I was like, okay, yeah, this will work. This works. And then one of them says to me, she had been like one of my backyard neighbors, right? We were close. She's known me for a long time. I've known her while she's had 2 of her 3 kids. Like, we were close. And we're sitting at this table having brunch. And she says to me, I'm so glad I knew you before you came out, because if I had just met you right now, I probably wouldn't be able to let my kids come over on a play date. And that was the realization of, oh, shit. Like, this entire community doesn't even know how homophobic they are. Like, the self-awareness is just not even present at all. So, unfortunately, that burned me for quite a while. So, when other friends from that community reached out, like, I didn't respond well, because it didn't feel safe to be that vulnerable around them, and I didn't know what was going to come flying out of their mouth. But it did teach me a lesson of, they just need some self-awareness. They just need some education. They are very good, loving people who just need to like level up a little bit, right? So that they can express that love and kindness to everyone instead of just heterosexuals.
And I mean, I think the internet in some ways is very helpful for educating people about this stuff. And in some ways it's pretty harmful, because there's a whole community of damaged queers out there with no tolerance left after what they've been through. And if someone says something even slightly wrong, even if they're supportive, this mob kind of dogpiles on them. And I get it. I do. It's so frustrating to have to deal with homophobia, both big and small, in your day-to-day life. It's exhausting. But I know it's not fair, but sometimes you kind of have to, even not engage is an option with these people, because you could burn them and prevent them from wanting to try and learn. And that's not fair. You should be able to be righteously angry sometimes, but save it for the people who really deserve it. I mean, the people in political power who are punching down, like, don't dogpile on some random person on the internet who's trying to understand.
Who might be exactly trying to understand in their own way. And that took me to thinking about, okay, where's the bigot in my own head that I'm not aware of? Because here I have all these people that are wonderful people that I've known for so long, who now it's very clear that they have a bigot in their head that they're not aware of. Okay, so I must too. I must as well, right? And then I was able to have some empathy for them. Then I was able to, because I did identify the bigot in my own head that has kind of been calling the shots in a few areas. And then I was able to look at these friends and be like, okay, I get it. I get it. You're just not aware.
That's really powerful. I'm gonna steal that from you. My own mental health. I thought you're gonna say something about like recognizing white privilege and other things like that, which is great. I mean, my queerness was definitely a bridge to understanding a lot of other marginalized communities and seeing how I have privilege in some areas of my life, don't have it in others, and how I can help people with less. So my queerness, I'm always less afraid of talking to other queer people because there is, you know, racism and ableism and other things in the queer community, but, you know, they at least hopefully have some base level experience with identifying with people in a marginalized community, ideally.
I think that's a good space to sort of end episode one. Elena, where can people find you online if they want to connect with you?
Oh, great. So it's funny because I'm kind of in a transition point. If you want to really connect, I am most open on Instagram under Elena Joy Experience. If you want to connect to me about public speaking, which no one's doing public speaking right now, thank you, Corona, my website right now is elenajoyexperience.com. But I am just this week launching the Pride and Joy Foundation. So you can go to prideandjoyfoundation.com. There's a preview page and a way for you to get in on the ground floor being a founding member. And then that'll have a soft launch in May and then a hard launch in June for Pride Month. So I'm super excited about supporting those families.
Fantastic. Thank you. Ray, where can people find you online?
Well, I'm easy because my name is Rady Magden everywhere. Facebook, my page is Rady Magden, RAEDMAGDON. Same on Twitter, at Rady Magden. Tumblr, Rady Magden. Website, http://radymagden.com. So, yeah, but I'm everywhere.
You have been listening to Ask a Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Oscar series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena, my pronouns are she, her, and I was joined today by two amazing guests, Elena and Ray. You can find their contact details in the show notes, should you wish to reach out to them. That's all for this episode.